Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Life isn't an easy road to navigate. We're moody creatures, susceptible to an array of psychological setbacks, emotional ups and downs, fruitless searches for meaning, and trials posed by anxiety, depression, and despair. The kind of journey one needs a survival guide for, and my guest today says, one of the best can be found in the writings of existential philosophers. His name is Gordon Marino. He's a football and boxing coach, a professor of philosophy, and the author of The Existentialist Survival Guide, How to Live Authentically in an Inauthentic Age. Gordon and I begin our conversation with how he personally found existentialism and how his coaching intersects with his teaching. We then get into what existential philosophy is all about and the thinkers and authors who are considered to be existentialists. Gordon shares what he thinks is the greatest existential novel and which of Soren Kierkegaard's books he most recommends reading. From there, we delve into what Kierkegaard had to say about anxiety, how he thought existential angst was the ultimate teacher, the distinction he drew between depression and despair, and why he argues that procrastination is one of our greatest moral dangers. We then unpack the different models of living an authentic life that the existentialist espoused and what Nietzsche meant with his injunction to live dangerously. We then get into what the existentialist take on love is, why love is actually hard to accept, and why you should presuppose love in others, and we end our conversation with what boxing can teach about existential philosophy. After the show's over, make sure to check out our show notes at aom.is/existential. All right, Gordon Marino, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Been looking forward to it.
Yeah, so you are a professor of philosophy at St. Olaf College. You're the author of the book, The Existentialist Survival Guide, How to Live Authentically in an Inauthentic Age. Let's talk about your backstory of how you became a professor of existential philosophy. How did you discover existential philosophy? And just tell us about that. I think it's really interesting.
Well, I was a football player at Bowling Green State University, and I had this wonderful, wonderful professor in a philosophy class. And he told me, well, you know about elite athletics and stuff like that, but you need to get some elite training in the mind. And so I transferred to Columbia University. And his name was Serge Kapper, a huge influence. So there, I studied philosophy there. And it was later on that I got it was during a time when I went through a terrible divorce as a young man, a very hard time. And I was in a coffee shop and picked up this book of Kierkegaard's, and it was like a light. It's just a beautiful, amazing page, because one of the things I was having such a hard time, and one of the things I found was that Kierkegaard and other existentialists really addressed the impediments in our lives, our inner lives, and the difficulties we face in being decent people. I mean, it's easy to be a good person when everything's going well, but quite different when you hit when the lights turn red.
Right. It's easy in theory, but when you actually have to do it, it gets a lot harder. And you're also a boxing coach at St. Olaf.
I'm not at St. Olaf. I'm a professional boxing coach and a trainer and an USA boxing coach. So I've trained both amateurs and pros in over 30 years, mostly kids in town, although I've had a couple boxers from St. Olaf.
And how has that influenced your thinking about philosophy, boxing?
Well, the teaching and coaching really influence one another, really go together in an important way. Being a coach helps me be a better teacher, helps me read kids more accurately, know who to push, when to push, that kind of thing. And it's really, I also coach football here. And I found that you really get the landscape of when you have somebody in class and in the gym and or the football field, you really get to see the landscape of their mind in a way that you wouldn't have otherwise. And it's really remarkable, because some kids, if I hadn't had them on the football field, they wouldn't have opened up, and I wouldn't have known how rich their thinking was. So it's been marvelous like that. Now, of course, I get a lot of questions of how can you train these people's brains and at the same time get them bashed in and stuff like that. So I get a lot of jabs about that over the years. Less so now, but in the beginning.
Yeah. Well, what do you respond to that?
I'm very careful with my boxers, and I've never had anybody get hurt or close to it. So I don't think people understand that if it's well supervised, boxing can be quite safe.
Right. And I mean, we've had Mark Edmondson on the podcast.
Oh yeah.
Professor.
Sure.
Yeah. At Virginia.
University of Virginia.
Yeah. And he wrote that book, Why Football Matters. And
yeah,
I thought, I mean, he answers that too, that sort of question. Like, how can you, be in favor of a sport that where people get, traumatic brain injury or whatever. And, it's a tough one, but he still thinks there's value in the sport because it can teach you something about life that you can't otherwise learn in the classroom.
Right. And there's also a risk in living a risk-averse life. That's something you learn from Kierkegaard. It's very important. One of his main ideas is that to not to venture, not to risk, is to take one of the greatest risks in life. So
right. Well, that's a good transition, you know, sport as a way to transition to existential philosophy. But let's start with this. Like, what is existentialism for those who aren't familiar with it? You know, what philosophical questions are the existential philosophers primarily concerned with?
Well, they're a real motley crew, and they're joined more by themes than by any kind of general theory. So the themes are very much things like the individual, there's limits of rationality, limits of the idea of clarity, being concrete in your thinking, right? I'm relating your thought to your existence, not being too abstract. Again, dealing with addressing painful emotions like despair, depression, anxiety, the issue of freedom, choice. Those are some of the themes that link. And everybody has a different roster. Who's on the roster? Some people have Shakespeare on there, you know. So it's quite an array of a lack of agreement about who's really an existentialist. And actually, only Camus and maybe Marcel and Simone de Beauvoir ever really identified themselves. I'm sorry, Sartre, not Camus. Camus denied he was an existentialist. But there's only two or three people that ever identified themselves as such, and only for a short time. But I identify myself as an existentialist.
Right. Well, you said there's a motley crew. I mean, not only are there philosophers, but there's also, people lump in novelists there as well. So
Kafka.
Yeah, let's talk about, that's right. Yeah, let's, like, who are some of the big names that people get usually thrown around as existentialists?
Okay. So certainly Kierkegaard, Sartre, Nietzsche, Camus, those are some of the main ones. Simone de Beauvoir. Okay. In terms of novelists, we have Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Miguel de Unamuno, those are some of the people who read. In fact, everybody should read Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Illich, which is the greatest existential novel ever. Unbelievable. Amazing book.
I've also heard, like, you know, Thoreau and Emerson thrown in there as well every now and then.
Yeah, there's connections, I think, there. Yeah, I mean, Nietzsche carried around, there's a book that argues that that European philosophy was very much influenced by American philosophy in the sense that and Nietzsche always carried around a copy of Emerson, you know, and so yeah, there's some overlapping themes.
I mean, how does existentialist flux? It kind of started coming to, I mean, the first existential philosopher was Kierkegaard. That's kind of how people point to him.
That's how many people,
right? But like, how does existentialism differ from philosophy before existentialism? Like, what's the big difference?
Oh, okay, one of the big differences is that this understanding of the lack of limits of reason. Right. So for Kierkegaard to become mature is to understand that there's a lot of things beyond our understanding that are important to life. So another thing is this idea of making your ideals concrete. So he thinks a lot of people, there's a lot of talk about, say, social justice or whatever. Then you have to ask yourself, well, what really have I done to advance that at all? Have I done anything? Have I walked the talk, to use a cliche? You know, and so there's a lot of emphasis on that, on action, that you don't find in other philosophies.
And I mean, also it seems like existentialism is somewhat, it's psychological too.
Yeah.
Like, as you said, I think Kierkegaard said, like, the idea of the self, like, what is the self? And it's like, the self is the self relating to itself or something like that.
Yep, that's something like that. That's from the opening page of The Sick, Sign of Death, which I think is his greatest book. So if your listeners are interested in one book of Kierkegaard's, I would certainly recommend The Sick, Sign of Death. And in that book, I've really found this distinction in him between despair and depression, between a spiritual disorder and a psychological disorder. But for Kierkegaard, we're born with a self that we need to become. For him, it's we're born a child of God, that we need to be loving, nurturing human beings, faithful. And with my students, a lot of time, I really press them to think not just about what they want to do, which they're kind of obsessed with, but what kind of human being do you want to be? What kind of person do you want to be? And there's a lot of that emphasis in Kierkegaard.
Well, let's talk about some of the questions you tackle in the Existential Survival Guide that you think existentialism, you know, these are big life questions, mm-hmm. that you think the existentialists have some, not answers, but, like, you know, questions to help you start thinking about this stuff. And the one question that existentialists grapple with is anxiety. Yeah. So I think everyone here who's listening to the podcast probably heard this or used the phrase, you know, existential angst.
Right.
And the existential philosopher who really explored this idea the most of existential anxiety was Kierkegaard. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what is existential angst, and how does that differ from anxiety about, you know, a test that you're taking in college?
Right, right. Well, existential angst, the way it's used today, it means it's a kind of a threat to our existence, right? That's the notion. But one of the things with Kierkegaard was that he insisted that the fact that we're anxious, anxiety is, in a sense, our kind of visceral understanding of the fact that we're free. It's a blessing to be anxious, right? And it's not a symptom of an illness. It's something that marks us out as spirits, as self, because we're free. It's an anxiety that you understand that you're free. And he thinks anxiety is one of the greatest teachers. It's contrary to what a lot of people in the medical profession would say, that we need to be able to sit with anxiety. And today we have so little patience for that. It's just a symptom, get rid of it, this kind of thing. And so it's quite a different view between Kierkegaard and the medical establishment on that issue.
Didn't he say something that also, like, the human beings are unique in the world, that we're the combination of the infinite and the finite?
That's right. Yeah, you got it. You got it. You're gonna get an A in the course. Yeah, definitely. Right. Yeah, right. Yeah. That we had these. He thought this is what you're looking at. You're referring again to sickness on a death, and there he says we have these different aspects of ourselves: finitude, infinitude, temporality, eternity, possibility, and necessity. These are contradictory kind of aspects of our lives, and as human being, we have to be able to relate those things to one another, to be able to get some balance, to integrate them.
Right. And so, I mean, that's hard to integrate the infinite with the finite. And it's something did Kierkegaard think it'd ever be resolved?
No. One of Kierkegaard's main messages is that life is an ongoing process. So you can never, so for people who say, well, I've been saved, it's all over, he'd say, that's baloney. That's bull, you know, that it's always, life is always a struggle. You always have to battle against certain temptations or whatever, right? There's no end to it, right? Right. So it's a process. He's very adamant about that. And then at any moment you could lose it. I mean, so he talks about, has this one story in the book that you've looked at, Sickness on a Death, about a monk from India who's lived on dew his whole life. He comes into the city, has one drink, and becomes an alcoholic. So that's what our situation is. We're that vulnerable. We're that fragile. We need to remember that.
And it sounds like for Kierkegaard, like anxiety can teach you, yeah. I mean, like it would, if you didn't feel anxiety, would Kierkegaard say something's wrong with you?
Oh yeah, he'd say you were spiritless. He literally says that in the concept of anxiety, right? That it's a mark that we're spirits, right? And that we want to do, and the anxiety is really about this, our spiritual potential. And he would say that what many of us do is concretize our anxiety, kind of finitize it in terms of, I'm afraid I won't get this job, or I'm afraid of doing this interview, or doing this or doing that, right? We try to turn our anxiety into these finite fears to escape it, right? That's one of his views. It's kind of a defense mechanism against the anxiety, but the anxiety is really about, we have the potential to become human beings, full persons for him, which again, for him, means being a person of faith. But if faith, the idea of faith is offensive to you, it would mean, look, your main task in life is not to sit on the beach, not to accrue, build your resume up, but to be a decent human being.
Yeah, and that idea of being spiritless, if you don't have anxiety, like, reminds me of Nietzsche's, like, The Last Man, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's a good connection, very good connection, yeah. Yeah, it's funny because Nietzsche did read some Kierkegaard late in the 1880s, apparently, and they disagree on a lot, but they both agree that nihilism is this sense that nothing matters is the greatest danger. And for the last man, he just wants to, the last man is just concerned about, when's my vacation, who divides your life into work time and play time, and, you know, what's on Netflix tonight. And, you know, so yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, the last man is, like, I've heard it described as, I forgot the name of the guy who's like the Nietzsche expert, he died, Solomon.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
he described the last man as the ultimate couch potato.
That's right. That's a good description. Yeah, Solomon was very good. Yeah,
yeah.
No, that's a really good description of the good couch potato.
Yeah, just watches Netflix and just blinks. That's all life is. Okay, so we talked about anxiety, and I guess Kierkegaard doesn't have much of a solution. Just kind of sit with it, learn what the anxiety can teach you with you.
That's right. There's no solution. Yeah, the solution would be to sit with it and not finitize it, not because he thinks it's dangerous. He says it can lead to suicide. So in that sense, you recognize it can be very dangerous. But yeah, to sit with it and not to translate it into what I'm really anxious about is whether or not, I get into med school or this or that, right?
Right.
And it's okay to be anxious about those things, but that's not that shouldn't become your sense of identity. So can I make a little turn here?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so for him, I think there's three this is where we can get into this distinction for him between despair and depression. For him, it's basically three selves. You have a concrete self, right? The self you are. And then you have this ideal self. And then there's this self you were born to be, this child of God, right? So when this concrete self doesn't become its ideal self, you might get all your anxiety, all your fears, or am I going to get into med school or whatever, right? He says when the concrete self doesn't get to be its ideal self, it can't stand, it wants to get rid of itself. It can't stand being itself, right? It's kind of a self-hatred. And he also says that for the person who does become successful, so that's despair. Despair is wanting to be rid of yourself. Got it?
Got it.
Okay? Right. And it sounds, this kind of despair sounds a lot like depression. Okay. But he also says the person who realizes the dream is equally in danger because they become the big shot or whatever. Right. And they don't think about, look, I'm real. This is whether or not I'm, you know, head of the rotary or all kinds of whatever stuff, you know, that's not the aim in life. It's to become this, a certain kind of human being. He says they're also in despair, even though they don't feel bad. So for Kierkegaard, despair is not a feeling. It's a state of the self, of being unaware of being a self and or being unwilling to be a self, whereas depression is this kind of self-hatred. And I think we've lost that distinction.
Right. So yeah, with depression today, like we've medicalized it. Like time you feel sad, like we'd be like, well, here, and even like grief, like here, take this, this antidepressant, you'll feel better. And Kierkegaard would say maybe don't do that. That's not maybe that's not healthy.
Yeah, learn to sit with. And I don't think he'd be against all medications. I mean, and there's times when when they can really rob us of our sense. You know, life can rob us of our sense of agency at some point. But we've gotten to the point where we have a very low threshold for dealing with anxiety and being able to sit with our feelings, sit with bad feelings. And I think that's been lost. You know, I think we need to really work at that. You know, in our society. Yeah, as you said, I mean, sometimes though, when people are dying, doctors will prescribe serotonin uptake drugs or antidepressants to the family as a kind of prophylactic against grief, right? So we've taken human predicaments that are going to hit us all and turn them into pathologies, illnesses.
Right.
And I think Kierkegaard would take great issue with that.
And this idea, this distinction between depression and despair, like there's people, Kierkegaard was a depressive, and, you know, you quote these lines where he's at the party, he was witty, and then when he came home, he wanted to kill himself.
Right.
And he write that in his journal. But he said, it's normal to feel down like that. The thing you got to be careful of, like you said, you can't let that depression fall into despair.
Okay, but despair here would not be like, it would be giving up on the project of, I mean, suppose you got some terrible disappointment and you said, screw it, man, I don't care anymore. And you give up on the project of being a good, faithful person, right? That's when despair comes in, not with the bad feelings, right? It's when you
give up
on being a self, give up on being a human being.
Right.
You know, so that's where I think the distinction between despair and depression comes in. You can, I mean, he says, so he acknowledged he was depressive, but he doesn't think he was in despair.
And how do you know if you're in despair or not?
Okay, that's a complicated question for him because you have to have the right concept. So he says a lot of people in this world will they'll experience a jolt, something terrible will happen, and they'll say they're in despair. Yeah, they're right, they're in despair, but they have the wrong concept. So you know what I mean? So they're right that they're in despair, but it's as though they don't understand what despair really is. The real despair is they've given up on being a self, right?
Right.
That's not an issue for them.
So it'd be like, okay, I like the example to explore this idea with the person who's doing well in life, who's happy, got a great job, great family, but they're still in despair, Kierkegaard said, because maybe they've given up on being that self, that true self.
Yeah, everybody's patting them on the back. They don't really think who their true self is. They ask themselves, Have I been a good, faithful person, right? That's really, and if you're rich and powerful, nobody gives you any crap, right?
Right.
You just patch on the back and you're able to give money away without making any sacrifices. And it's very, very intoxicating. So again, you could do that and you could be very successful and be very happy. He thought happiness was really just a matter of, you know, we make a God term out of it for Kierkegaard. It was just had a lot to do with luck, fortune, you know? And it was a passing kind of thing. And it shouldn't be the aim of our life. self-fulfillment happiness.
Right.
Our aim should be decent human beings.
But even these like happy, successful people, they might have those moments where they recognize, like they're lying in bed at night and they realize, this is empty. This is not... So like they recognize the despair, but Kierkegaard would say, well, you might have the wrong concept of it, because what they probably end up doing is they just keep doing more of the same, right?
It's interesting that you just bring that up. That's a good point, because he recognizes that kind of a person where they have this glimmers of like, yeah, everyone thinks I'm really great, but something's missing. And he says they generally go right back to sleep. They just jump into it again and try to forget those moments. He says that's the ordinary tendency. But yeah, that's a good example of some big CEO sitting in bed at night and he's placed on the beach or whatever. And he's thinking, well, you know, I'm very successful, but right.
Right.
And the next day he's back to work or she's back to work.
And then would Kierkegaard say that as soon as you recognize that disconnect between who you are and who you should be, you got to act, like you have to do something immediately or otherwise you'll just start rationalizing like, well, I got a mortgage to pay. I've got to do this thing. I got to do that.
You know, that's an excellent question, because a lot of people ask about Kierkegaard's ethics. And I think his greatest contribution to ethics was this idea that of our capacity for self-deception, and we don't need more ethics classes or workshops, whatever. We need to hold on to truths that are going to lead us against our self-interest a lot of time, right? I think I bring it up in the book, this case where, you know, I was going to tax resist because of our involvement in Nicaragua with the Contras. And a friend of mine told me who was down there was saying they were killing all the midwives, the Contras, right? And I'm going to tax resist, right? But at the same time, I was up for a finalist for a Fulbright. And someone says, well, you tax resist, and guess what's going to happen with a Fulbright? And I said to myself, well, yeah, I think I better wait until later on in life. I can make a stronger stand. So he thought procrastination was one of our greatest moral dangers, as you're mentioning, right? Yeah, that if you think about it too long, you're going to convince yourself that the right way is the easy way.
Right.
And that's a very important insight. You know, I think really important insight that you can convince yourself that the right way is the easy way, when in fact the right way is oftentimes going to lead you into a collision with the world.
The example you just gave of your own personal experience of like, it reminded me, we talked about Mark Edmondson not too long ago, but he had that great book, Self and Soul, where he explored, I think it's an existential book. He explores this idea. There's these two selves inside of you that are competing. And sometimes, you know, the soul part, which is sort of our higher conception, you know, that true self that Kierkegaard would say.
Right.
And there's oftentimes in life when those, like their self part, which is like, you know, our need for recognition, our need for money, whatever, that conflicts, and you have to decide, you know, what is it you really want?
That's right. Well, it's not so much what you really want, it's what you should do, right? What's the right thing to do? Yeah, that's true. And a lot of times, I mean, I think in the course of history, I've always mentioned that, you know, the family is treated as the core of all moral values, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of times it's the biggest temptation to doing the right thing. For example, when lynchings these thousands of lynchings that took place in America, there were people in those towns that hated them, disagreed with them, but you spoke out, you were gone. And then if you're in that situation where you're going to want to speak out and you got kids, you say, well, you know, I got my family. What do you think, Nelson Mandela? He had kids, you know? So sometimes the family can become a moral temptation, I think, to hide by. Yeah, I'm sure that was the case in Nazi Germany, right? I'd resist, but I have a family to take care of.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's hard. That's a tough one to think about.
But it could also make life easy, because then you're free from any kind of having to make some painful decisions too.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's INDOCHINO.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness. rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show. Well, let's talk about another question that existentialists grappled with, is the idea of authenticity. And everyone talks about authenticity these days.
You think so? I don't hear.
Well, they talk about it, I don't think, in the way that existentialists, like, I mean, a couple of years ago, you'd see companies really, you know, talk about, we have authentic artisanal whatever.
Oh yeah, that's
right?
True.
Right. Yeah. And
companies don't market anything.
Right.
That's right. Yeah, that's true.
Or like, you know, people on sort of self-help type people, they're like, you got to live your true self. I'm living my truth. I got to be authentic. And yeah, I think we have the existentialists to thank for, you know, this sort of, I don't know, this watered down version of authenticity. But let's talk about, what did the existentialists think, what it meant to be an authentic person?
Well, Kierkegaard didn't use that term very much, although it's dragged out of a lot. People find it in him. So for him, it would become your true self. Okay, but I think there's someone like Nietzsche would have thought that to become authentic was an act of self-creation, which is a lot of what people, I think, at some level think today, right? It's to not define yourself in terms of the crowd, to become what he calls the sovereign individual. You know, so there's this one notion of authenticity that might involve you have this true self, which you're born to become, right? And the other is authenticity is creating yourself. And so those are two different takes on it. But I think we also have to consider the possibility. Well, I mean, suppose you're a real jerk and you're authentic. I mean, so authenticity could be a bad thing if you're an evil person, you know. So it wouldn't always be a good thing in that sense. But two different models there. Do you have this self you're born to be, or is it one of creating yourself to doing what you feel like, really, you know, which is the one I think that's marketed most today. Right. Follow your passions, that kind of stuff.
And what would the existentialists think about? I mean, would they, like the follow your passion thing, would they, I guess, would some of them be on board with that? Or would they be like,
Again, they disagree on a lot. I mean, you have atheists that are existentialists, you have true believers like CERN. But Kierkegaard was very emphatic about the importance of passion, right? That's for sure. But He wouldn't say that our destiny in life is to follow our passions. I mean, suppose I have a passion for playing beach volleyball or something, and I'm able to do it. Well, I wasn't put here on earth to play beach volleyball, you know, even though, right? I mean, so
right.
He would say we have duties and things like that are very important.
Well, he would say, like, I mean, I know Kierkegaard didn't say the word authentic, but he would say if we were to pull it out of him, like, for him, the authentic self would be like, you know, a child of God or whatever.
Or whatever. Or a good, I mean, for people who find talk of God blasphemy, you would be a good person, being a good person, being that's what you were born to be. You weren't put here to hike all day or ride your bike 1,000 miles. You were here to help each other. We're here to help hold hands and be together and help each other.
And I like this idea, you know, I think Nietzsche, he was famous for quoting the poet Pindar, become who you are.
Yeah,
your task in life is to become who you are, and I think that's an interesting concept because it's like, okay, you have to know who are you, like what is the you you're supposed to become, and then what does that process look like?
Yeah, but I think for Nietzsche, it's an artistic process. Becoming who you are is not like Kierkegaard, where you were born with self before God or whatever, right? And for Nietzsche, it's more. Rise above the crowd, develop the discipline. Don't evaluate yourself in terms of the market value or the herd, right? And it involves a lot of self-discipline and everything. And so he talks about it as a sovereign individual, but it's much more of an act of creation for him.
Gotcha.
Right, self-creation. And I think for Sartre as well, he thinks of it as like an artistic project. And I think Kierkegaard and Dostoevsky probably would disagree with that. You know?
Right.
But what do you think of authenticity? What are your thoughts on it?
I don't know. Like, it's one of those. So I've
read. Who do you think are authentic people? Who have you said, man, that person's authentic?
Man, so, I mean, I've met a few people. Like, so I think Kierkegaard described this person, you know, going back to Kierkegaard's sort of Christian roots, like the person without guile.
Yeah, I think
like,
so
you
too.
Like you interact with them and you know they've got no other agenda. They're just nothing up their sleeve. I've interacted with a few people like that, and it's like really refreshing because it's just like.
And don't you think
you don't?
At home in their skin in some way, at home in themselves without being arrogant or something like that. I associate that with but you're right. Being a little in a, I think it's Nathaniel, the disciples meet the tree, and Jesus says something like, "He's a person of no guile." Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah, nothing up your sleeve.
And I also like, I mean, the idea of when I've thought about the become who you are thing from Nietzsche. So it is an act of self-creation, but I think the way I've read it is that Nietzsche would recognize there are limitations to your creation, right? You have to sort of understand the limits that you have. So like for me, example, I'm not particularly athletic. So like becoming an NBA or an NFL player, probably not in the books for me. But but there's other things that I could do.
Yeah.
With discipline and will that I could become who I am.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I think that's right. He certainly want us to encourage you to recognize the necessity, the concreteness in your life. Yeah. Now but unlike Kierkegaard, he wouldn't have any normative kind of moral parameters on that. So if you wanted to become, if you were like a Viking type person or a killer or something like that, and that's what your true passion worked at, I don't know what there is in Nietzsche that would say you can't do that, that that's wrong.
Right.
So he's kind of, he doesn't have a lot of normative force there.
Right.
But he has things that teach us about the moral life. I mean, in particular, not to be that much of our lives driven by resentment, envy, emotions like that. So I think he's, and even for people of faith, I think he's very refreshing and very insightful. Yeah. And to let things go. Like he read, before he wrote The Genealogy of Morals, which is one of his greatest books, he read Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. And it's all about this capacity for self-laceration, for tearing ourselves apart. For Nietzsche, you recognize you did something wrong, you let it go. I mean, forget about it. I mean, you try to change your ways, but you don't just chew yourself up about it, right? And he thinks there's a lot of that in our society, a tendency to, what he calls bad conscience, to turn all aggressions inward. So he says, like, for example, to forgive someone is to just forget it, right? There's a lot of like, yeah, I'll forgive you because I need to move on in my life, as though forgiveness were a form of therapy. It's not. He said, you need to forget it. Let it go. So that's an important moral insight on his part.
Yeah, I guess Nietzsche would say the noble soul would do that. Like the noble, he would just, they'd forget it. But like the resentful, the person filled with resentment would hold that grudge forever, basically.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that's a beautiful, that's a refreshing insight, the way he describes it. But he says that even with respect to our own lives, right? Like, have you ever, I don't know, I've had times when I just gone over, I can't believe I did such and such. Oh my God, man. You know, like stuff from 50 years ago, whatever. And it's like, let it go, man. Like, don't last. He thinks this kind of self-laceration is part of what he calls a slavery bill, but that's another story. And Camus would agree. And if you read Camus' The Fall, amazing book, right? This tendency towards self-laceration.
You know, speaking of Nietzsche's sort of ideas about ethical and moral decision, one thing you kind of suss out from him is that Nietzsche he has a call for people to live dangerously. What do you think he means by that?
Well, to take risks, right? And so that's another, that's something, again, where Kierkegaard and Nietzsche would complement one another, is that this willingness to take risks, to venture, right? Which he thinks in our society is, keep all their bases open. We live, very pragmatic. And he says, no, man, live dangerously, take chances. I yell at my students when they don't speak up in class. I'll come on, live dangerously. Ask a damn question, will you? Right? I mean, they're like, we're reading Nietzsche and they're afraid to raise their hand. So I say, come on, live dangerously. Ask a question. We're not leaving until I get three questions, I'll say. But yeah, so this willingness to take risks.
Well, I love the story you give that's related to that. You talk about how around exam time, you get all these emails from your students asking like, what's going to be on the test? Is this answer, would this answer be right? And you finally have to tell them, like, you guys just need to get a grip. Right. Because they're concerned about, I got to get the A so I can graduate and get the internship, whatever. They're thinking last man. They're being like last men, Nietzsche would say. And you would say, you guys got to get a grip. Like, you talked about, it was like the anniversary of D-Day. And you're saying,
that's right.
There was 20 year olds who were just, they were storming that's Normandy. Right. And you're worried about whether you're going to get an A on this test.
That went over really big. Yeah, I said, hey, man, about this time in 1944, Eisenhower came out and said, most of you people won't be coming back tomorrow, baby. Most of you people won't be coming back. I said, that wasn't something to be anxious about. Get it and get a grip. And, oh, man, that was, some people didn't like that talk.
Right. But I mean, they wanted to play it safe. Like they wanted to know they wanted to fill in the box. But you would say, Nietzsche would say, like, for a test about existentialisms, like Nietzsche would say, be bold, live dangerously, answer something that, it's coming, from yourself, that creates something. Even if the professor doesn't like it, like he would say, just go for it.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say, yes, I don't know. I've had some students go for it, miss. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Rather than leave the blank, but yeah, but do your studying, but don't be so scared of, like, I mean, students they'll freak out if they don't get an A and they get an A minus. I mean, that kind of stuff. They're just so frightened of not being successful, of not, this kind of obsession with their, whatever, right? And as opposed to, they don't, a lot of, I mean, academically, what happens all the time is they won't take any risks. People will only take courses they know they can get a good grade in. They won't study. They'll come to a liberal arts college and won't stretch themselves. Won't study things that they wouldn't, you know, that aren't in their bailiwick. So, yeah. But that's where the coaching comes in, though. When at times like that, where I'm like, get a grip, stop the baby stuff, will you?
Take a punch.
Yeah, man. And they'll come.
And going back to sort of Kierkegaard's idea of like, you know, he would agree with Nietzsche about this idea of you got to live dangerously. For him, this kind of segues nicely to Kierkegaard's concept of faith. Mm-hmm. You know, for Kierkegaard, faith was kind of a scary thing. It was a dangerous thing for Kierkegaard.
Yeah, I would disagree with Freud. Someone of Freud who says, believe because we want protection. To stand before God, to realize, that's terrifying for Kierkegaard. And to stand out from the crowd, he thinks it requires great imagination, right? Because, you know, he says to book that faith is an offense to reason. It's a collision with the understanding, you know? So it's very scary. I mean, I don't see any proof of Jesus and going around or anybody getting up from the grave lately, you know? So yeah, it's scary for him. Yeah.
So, I mean, another concept or an idea that existentialists grapple with is the idea of love.
Yeah.
How do they, I mean, obviously they had differing ideas about what love was or what it meant in life. What sort of kind of is a bird's eye view of what existentialists thought about love?
For Kierkegaard, it was a passion, a duty, right? It involved a feeling. He has all these, it's a lot of different immiscibles, but it's primarily a duty. We have a duty to love others. And that involves a lot of things like becoming blind to their sins and that kind of a thing. Sartre doesn't write about it that much, but I found one of the most illuminating passages was from Dostoevsky in the Notes from Underground, where he thinks that we have a hard time accepting. I mean, it's so amazing to be loved by someone who friggin' knows you, right? I mean, who knows what a jerk you can be, right? I mean, that's just remarkable. I mean, we all want to be loved for like being cool or, you know, our accomplishments, right? But I've said this at weddings, but to be loved by someone who really knows you, good and bad qualities, is just amazing. And Dostoevsky said we have a hard, because of the power dynamic, we don't want, the problem is a lot of time to accept being loved for who you are, right? It's not, we always think of love as, I want to get as much as I can, or I want people to love me. No, he says it's really one of being able to accept love from someone who knew you. I think he thinks that's the problem. That's one of the offensive things about Christianity is that Jesus knows us and loves us and forgives us. And there's nothing that makes, Dostoevsky thinks there's nothing that makes people more angry than to be told, I forgive you, right? So we don't often think about the task of being able to accept love from people who know all our flaws. And I think that's a beautiful insight, right?
No, yeah. I like this quote in the book that you have. He says, we need the love of others to love ourselves, mm-hmm. but in order to be nurtured by the love of others, we need to love ourselves sufficiently to accept that love.
Yeah. And that's why I think one of the issues today with issues about race and social justice, I mean, all the boxers I train and Mexican immigrants, man, they get nothing but crap half the time. You know, everyone looked down on them like the invisible, right? That can affect your ability to love yourself. You know, we need to think of racism and this social injustice as infecting people's ability to love themselves. Because a lot of times when you have that kind of social injustice, you also have economic things going on at home that are bad. Parents are always pissed off or split up. You go to school angry. You get nothing but crap from teachers, you know. And so I think Kierkegaard missed the boat on this one. That to truly love ourselves, it really helps to get love from others and not be treated as dirt or invisible, which is how a great many human beings are treated.
Well, Kierkegaard did say this thing. He talks that you need to presuppose love in others, that other people are capable of love.
That's right. You've been doing your studying, man. Yeah, well, that's impressive. Yeah, that's right. I think there he's saying this is hard stuff because I like to hate certain people. There's certain people I really like to be angry at. But yeah, the task of love is to assume that the love in the other person, which I take to mean that it's to presuppose their ultimate goodness, which is, that's a leap of faith, right?
Yeah, that is a leap of faith.
And then, I mean, really, like somebody just don't think it's a monster, but just somebody just irritates the hell out of you, right? I mean, somebody just like, right? To just, you know, David Foster Wallace said, you probably heard, what is it, All's Water or
yeah,
Water?
Right.
Yeah, a beautiful, beautiful graduation speech, almost up there with some of Kurt Vonnegut's, whom I love. But this idea of like just thinking about what might be going on in someone else's life. Like a lot of times I've gotten pissed off at people and then found out later what they were going through. And that, so sometimes the impediments, so we feel like we're having a hard time presupposing love or caring about somebody who irritates the hell out of us. So at that point, we might want to catch that feeling and say, hey man, something's going on here. Or maybe, you know, could be something I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, like sometimes, yeah, whenever someone's annoying, we sometimes justify ourselves to not care about or love that person. It's like, well, they're annoying. They deserve it. Like they don't deserve.
Yeah.
But I mean, so Kierkegaard would say, I mean, by presupposing love in others, Kierkegaard's saying, I think maybe this is what he said, maybe tell me if I'm wrong, is that you're recognizing that the other person is spirit or yeah, has the potential that's for right, an authentic yeah, or whatever
yeah,
stuff. Let's bring back boxing into this. What do you think boxing can teach us about existential philosophy?
Well, it's not what boxing can teach us. It's what how boxing can change your life. Okay, so in order to be a decent, oh yeah, I guess there's a connection with existentialism. In order to, I keep harping on it, preaching, in order to be a good person, we got to be able to deal with emotions like anger and anxiety. But we don't get many workshops on that in everyday life. Where most people live in these protected circumstances, right? You know, where they're never, take some medication for your anxiety. Anger sometimes treated as more taboo than sexuality, you know? So, and those are really key emotions. And in boxing, it's like a workshop for dealing with those. You can't be, and you, George Foreman once told me, because he's a devout Christian and very, man, a great faith. I have a lot of respect for him. And he once told me, man, you know, boxing makes people less violent because you can't be successful at the sport unless you learn to control your emotions. You should see people in their first three or four bouts if they ever, it's just fight or flight. But over time, they learn how to control their emotions. But more than that, he said, you know, because he came back, his comeback, started his comeback after about being out of boxing 13 years to finance his gym he was running. And he said, man, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of kids in that gym that their parents never, their fathers never around, boy, but as soon as they start boxing, the folks are there. So all of a sudden, some people will get this affirmation that they don't get anywhere else in life, you know, and we all need affirmation sunlight, like most of us, you know, a lot of us are patted on the back, oh, you're smart, you're this, you're that. There's a lot of kids who never get that affirmation. And then they go to the boxing gym and they work at it. And man, they're going, you're cool. You're this, you know, that's really, you're something. We don't want just, you know, this kind of, well, respect for each other. So we need more than that. We need intimacy and a kind of closeness that you also get in a boxing gym. It's like a family, man. There's no racism in boxing. I mean, everybody, it's a family. But more than that, you get affirmed just by getting in the ring. And so that need for affirmation, I think, is huge and can make people blossom. I was a boxing writer for the Wall Street Journal for many, many years and HBO and everything. And you meet these champions who come from rough circumstances and you see how they've been molded by, how they've been changed by, you know, Mike Tyson's a friend. I mean, how they've been changed by the love they've gotten from the sport, you know, so self-discipline and affirmation can come out of boxing. And it can, and again, there's not many other players. Even when coaching football, nobody talks about courage anymore. It's all about strategy and all this technique and stuff like that. Boxing, man, it's like stick in there. You got to be courageous. You know, you got to deal with your fears. It's a workshop on that. But it's got to be in a place where, in a gym where people know what they're doing and it's safe.
Yeah, we've had a podcast guest on about that idea of affirmation. He made the case, people need two things. They need to be noticed and they need to be needed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And a lot of time we just talk about respect. Respect is such a cold idea, right? I mean, we got to respect others. Yeah, we got to respect others, but we need more than respect. We need love, man. We need togetherness. We need to be, sometimes to be told we're good at something. And it also involves telling people when they're screwing up. I mean, I think one of the things I learned from in boxing from my mentor, a Marine, when I used to the head coach at VMI, was to love somebody is to tell them stuff they don't want to hear. And so, you know, the loving thing to do sometimes, because most people don't want to do that because it leads to, you know, it's not fun. Person might get pissed off. That we need to be able, as mentors, to tell people things they don't want to hear sometimes, you know, and still let and you got to have that base of love where they know you're not rejecting them wholesale, right?
Well, Gordon, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about your work and your book?
Well, my book is The Existential Survival Guide. It's published by Harper, and you can just go on Amazon and get it in most bookstores. If people have questions, they can email me at marino@stoloff.edu. If I'm happy to take questions, I'm on Twitter at Gordon Marino. And I have a website, but I haven't got it. My kids try and help me get it up and running. And so I'd be happy to take any questions. And it's been a real joy talking with you. Yeah, really appreciate your knowledge of Kierkegaard, et cetera. So I'm giving you an A for the class.
I appreciate that. Well, Gordon Marino, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, my friend. Be well.
My guest today was Gordon Marino. He's the author of the book, The Existentialist Survival Guide. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Check out our show notes at aom.is/existential, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles we've written over the years. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout for a free month trial. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you can start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. If you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think we could something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, it's Brett McKay, reminding you not only listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.